16. That's what makes this wrong for a newspaper like the Globe, Vince said after a little pause to sip his milky coffee and collect his thoughts. Even if we wanted to give it up.
Which we don't,
Dave put in, and rather testily. Which we don't, Vince agreed. But if we did, Steffi, when a big city newspaper like the Globe or the New York Times does a feature story or a feature series, they want to be able to provide answers, or at least suggest them. And do I have a problem with that? The hell I do. Pick up any big city paper. What do you find on the front page? Questions disguised as news stories. Where is Osama bin Laden? We don't know. What's the president doing in the Middle East? We don't know, because he don't. Is the economy going to get stronger or go in a tank? Experts differ. Our eggs, good for you or bad for you, depends on which study you read. You can't even get the weather forecasters to tell you if a nor'easter is going to come in from the northeast because they get burned on the last one. So if they do a feature story on better housing for minorities, they want to be able to say if you do A, B, C, and D, things will be better by the year 2030. And if they do a feature story on unexplained mysteries, Dave said, they want to be able to tell you the coast lights were reflections on the clouds, and the church picnic poisonings were probably the work of a jilted Methodist secretary. But trying to deal with this business of the time, which you happen to have put your finger on, Vince added with a smile. And of course, it's outrageous no matter how you think of it, Dave said. But I'm willing to be outrageous, Vince said. Hell, I looked into the matter, just about dialed the phone off the damn wall, and I guess I've right to be outrageous. My father used to say you can cut chalk all day, yet it won't never be cheese, Dave said, but he was also smiling a little. That's true, but let me whittle a little bit just the same, Vince said. Let's say the elevator does close at 10:20 Mountain Time, okay? Let's also say, just for the sake of argument, that this was all planned out in advance, that he had a car standing by with the motor running. All right, Stephanie said, watching him closely.
Pure fantasy, Dave snorted, but he also looked interested.
It's far-fetched anyway, Vince agreed. But he was there at 10:15 at Jan's wife's site a little more than 5 hours later. That's also far-fetched. But we know it's fact. Now may I continue?
Have on, Macduff, Dave said.
If he's got a car all warmed up and waiting for him, maybe he can make it to Stapleton in half an hour. Now, he surely didn't take a commercial flight. He could have paid cash for his ticket and used an alias, that was possible back then. But there were no direct flights from Denver to Bangor. From Denver to any place in Maine, actually.
You checked.
I did. Flying commercial, the best he could have done was arrive in Bangor at 6:45 p.m., which was long after that counter girl saw him. In fact, at that time of the year, that's after the last ferry of the day leaves for Moosey.
Six is the last? Stephanie asked.
Yep, right up until mid-May, Dave said.
So he must have flown charter, she said. A charter jet? Are there companies that flew charter jets out of Denver, and could he have afforded one?
Yes, on all counts, Vince said. But it would have cost him a couple of $1,000, and their bank account would have shown that kind of hit.
It didn't? Vince shook his head.
There were no significant withdrawals prior to the fellow's disappearance. All the same, that's what he must have done. I checked with a number of different charter companies, and they all told me that on a good day, one when the jet stream was flowing strong and a little leer like a 35 or a 55 got up in the middle of it, that trip would take just 3 hours, maybe a little more.
Denver to Bangor, she said.
Denver to Bangor. Yeah, there's no place closer to our part of the coast where one of those little burners can land, not enough runway, don't you see?
She did. So did you check with the charter companies in Denver?
I tried. Not much joy there either, though. Of the five companies that flew jets of one size or another,
Only two had even talked to me. They didn't have to, did they? I was just a small-town newspaperman looking into an accidental death, not a cop investigating a crime. Also, one of them pointed out to me that it wasn't just a question of checking up on the FBOs that flew jets out of Stapleton.
What are FBOs?
Fixed base operators, Vince said. Chartering aircraft is only one of the things they do. They get clearances, maintain little terminals for passengers who are flying private so they can stay that way. They sell, service, and repair aircraft. You can go through U.S. Customs at lots of FBOs. Buy an altimeter if yours is busted, or catch 8 hours in the pilot's lounge if your current flying time is maxed out. Some FBOs, like Signature Air, are big business, chain operations, just like Holiday Inn or McDonald's. Others are seat-of-the-pants outfits, with not much more than a coin-op snack machine inside and a windsock by the runway.
You did some research, Stephanie said, impressed.
Oh, yeah, enough to know that it isn't just Colorado pilots and Colorado planes that used Stapleton or any other Colorado airport. Then or now. For instance, a plane from an FBO at LaGuardia in New York might fly into Denver with passengers who were going to spend a month in Colorado visiting relatives. The pilots would then ask around for passengers who wanted to go back to New York, just so they wouldn't have to make the return empty.
These days, they'd have their return passengers all set up ahead of time by computer, Dave said. Do you see, Steph?
She did. She saw something else as well. So the records on Mr. Cogan's wild ride might be in the files of Air Eagle out of New York.
Air Eagle out of Montpelier, Vermont, Vince said.
Just Ducky Jets out of Washington, D.C., Dave said.
And if Cogan paid cash, Vince added, there are quite likely no records at all.
But surely there are all sorts of agencies.
Yes, ma'am, Dave said. More than you could shake a stick at, beginning with the FAA and ending with the IRS. Wouldn't be surprised if the damn FFA wasn't in there somewhere. But in cash deals, paperwork gets thin. Remember Helen Hafner?
Of course she did. Their waitress at the Grey Gull, the one whose son had recently fallen out of his treehouse and broken his arm. She gets all of it, Vince had said of the money he meant to put in Helen Hafner's pocket. And what Uncle Sam don't know, don't bother him. To which Dave had added, it's the way America does business. Stephanie supposed it was, but it was an extremely troublesome way of doing business in a case like this one.
So you don't know, she said.
You tried your best, but you just don't know. Vince looked first surprised, then amused.
As to trying my best, Stephanie, I don't think a person ever knows that for sure. In fact, I think most of us are condemned, damned even, to thinking we could have done just a little smidge better, even when we went through to whatever it was we were trying to get. But you're wrong. I do know. He chatted a jet out of Stapleton. That's what happened.
But you said...
He leaned even further forward over his clasped hands, his eyes fixed on hers.
Listen carefully and take instruction, dear heart. It's long years since I read Sherlock Holmes, so I can't say this exactly, but at one point the great detective tells Dr. Watson something like this. When you eliminate the impossible, whatever is left, no matter how improbable, must be the answer. Now we know that the Colorado kid was in his Denver office building until 10:15 at 10:20 on that Wednesday morning, and we can be pretty sure he was in Jan's wharf site at 5:30. Hold up your fingers like you did before, Stephanie.
She did as he asked. Left forefinger for the kid in Colorado, right forefinger for James Cogan in Maine. Vince unlocked his hands and touched her right forefinger briefly with one of his own. Age meeting youth in midair.
But don't call this finger 5:30, he said. We needn't trust the counter girl, who wasn't run off her feet the way she would have been in July, but who was doubtless busy all the same, it being the supper hour and all.
Stephanie nodded. In this part of the world, supper came early. Dinner, pronounced dinner, was what you ate from your lunch pail at noon, often while out in your lobster boat.
Let this finger be 6 o'clock, he said. The time of the last ferry.
She nodded again. Had to be on that one, didn't he?
He did, unless he swam the reach, Dave said.
Or chartered a boat, she said.
We asked, Dave said. Maren Pott and we asked Gad Edwick, who was the ferryman in the spring of 80.
Did Cogan bring him tea? She suddenly found herself wondering. Because if you want to ride the ferry, you're supposed to bring tea for the tiller man. You said so yourself, Dave. Or are the ferryman and the tiller man two different people?
Steph? Vince sounded concerned. Are you all right, dear?
I'm fine. Why?
You looked, I don't know, like you came over strange.
I sort of did. It's a strange story, isn't it? And then she said, only it's not a story at all. You were so right about that. And if I came over strange, I suppose that's why. It's like trying to ride a bike across a tightrope that isn't there. Stephanie hesitated, then decided to go on and make a complete fool of herself. Did Mr. Edwick remember Cogan because Cogan brought him something? Because he brought tea for the tiller man? For a moment, neither man said anything, just regarded her with their inscrutable eyes, so strangely young and sweetly lad-like in their old faces. And she thought she might laugh or cry or do something, break out somehow just to kill her anxiety and growing certainty that she had made a fool of herself.
Vince said, "It was a chilly crossing. Someone, a man, brought a paper cup of coffee to the pilot house and handed it to Gad. They only passed a few words. This was April, remember, and by then it was already gone dark. The man said, "Smooth crossing." And Gad said, "Yeah." Then the man said, "This has been a long time coming. Maybe I've been a long time coming." Gad said it might have even been, "Little's been a long time coming." There is such a name. There's none in the Tinnock phone book, but I found it in quite a few others.
Was Cogan wearing the green coat or the top coat?
Steph, Vince said. Gad not only didn't remember whether or not the man was wearing a coat, he probably couldn't have sworn in a court of law if the man was afoot or on horseback. It was getting dark, for one thing. It was one little act of kindness and a few past words recalled a year and a half downstream for a second. For a third, well, old Gad, you know.
He made a bottle-tipping gesture.
Speak no ill of the dead, but the man drank like a frickin' fish, Dave said. He lost the ferryman job in 85. The town put him on the plow, mostly so his family wouldn't starve. He had 5 kids, you know, and a wife with MS. But finally he cracked up the plow doing Main Street while Blotto put out all the frickin' power for a frickin' week in February, padding my frickin' Francais. And he lost that job, so he was on the town. So am I surprised he didn't remember more? No, I am not. But I'm convinced, from what he did remember, that, the Colorado kid came over from the mainland on the day's last ferry, and, he brought tea for the tiller man, or a reasonable facsimile thereof. Good on you to remember about that, Steph.
He patted her hand. She smiled at him. It felt like a rather dazed smile.
As you said, Vince resumed, there's that 2-hour time difference to factor in.
He moved her left finger closer to her right.
It's 12:15 East Coast time when Cogan leaves his office. He drops his easy-going just another day act the minute the elevator doors open on the lobby of his building, the very second. He goes dashing outside, hell-bent for election, where that fast car and an equally fast driver is waiting for him. 30 minutes later, he's at a Stapleton FBO, and 5 minutes after that, he's mounting the steps of a private jet. He hasn't left this arrangement to chance, either. Can't have done. There are people who fly private on a fairly regular basis, then stay for a couple of weeks. The folks who take them one way spend those 2 weeks attending to other chatters. Our boy would have settled on one of those planes and almost certainly would have made a cash arrangement to fly back out with them, eastbound.
Stephanie said, what would he have done if the people using the plane he planned to take canceled their flight at the last minute?
Dave shrugged. Same thing he would have done if there was bad weather, I guess, he said. Put it off to another day.
Vince, meanwhile, had moved Stephanie's left finger a little further to the right.
Now it's getting close to 1 p.m. on the East Coast, he said. But at least our friend Cogan doesn't have to worry about a lot of security rigmarole. Not back in 1980, especially not flying private. And we have to assume, again, that he doesn't have to wait in line with a lot of other planes for an active runway, because it screws up the timetable if he does, and all the while, on the other end, he touched her right finger, that ferry's waiting. Last one of the day. So, the flight lasts 3 hours. We'll say that anyway. My colleague here got on the internet. He loves that sucker with a passion. And he says the weather was good for flying that day, and the maps show that the jet stream was in approximately the right place. But as to how strong it was, that's information I've never been able to pin down, Dave said. He glanced at Vince. Given the tenuousness of your case, partner, that's probably not a real bad thing.
We'll say 3 hours, Vince repeated, and moved Stephanie's left finger, the one she was coming to think of as her Colorado Kid finger, until it was less than 2 inches from her right one, which she now thought of as her James Cogan almost dead finger.
It can't have been much longer than that.
Because the facts won't let it, she murmured, fascinated and in truth a little frightened by the idea. Once, while in high school, she had read a science fiction novel called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. She didn't know about the moon, but she was coming to believe that was certainly true of time.
No, ma'am, they won't, he agreed. At 4 o'clock, or maybe 4:05, we'll say 4:05, Cogan lands and disembarks at Twin Cities Civil Air. That was the only FBO at Bangoa International Airport back then.
Any records of his arrival, she asked? Did you check? Knowing he had, of course he had. Also knowing it hadn't done any good one way or another. It was that kind of story. The kind that's like a sneeze which threatens but never quite arrives. Vince smiled.
Sure did. But in the carefree days before Homeland Security, all Twin City kept any length of time were their account books. They had a good many cash payments that day, including some pretty good-sized refueling tabs late in the afternoon, but even those might mean nothing. For all we know, whoever flew the kid in might have spent the night at a Bangoa hotel and flown out the next morning.
I spent the weekend, Dave said. Then again, the pilot might have left right away and without refueling at all.
How could he do that after coming all the way from Denver, Stephanie asked.
Could have hopped down to Portland, Dave said, and filled his tank up there.
Why would he? Dave smiled. It gave him a surprisingly foxy look that was not much like his usual expression of earnest and slightly stupid honesty. It occurred to Stephanie now that the intellect behind that chubby, rather childish face was probably as lean and quick as Vince Teague's.
Cogan might have paid Mr. Denver Flyboy to do it that way, because he was afraid of leaving a paper trail, Dave said. And Mr. Denver Flyboy would very likely have gone along with any reasonable request if he was being paid enough.
As for the Colorado Kid, Vince resumed, he's still got almost 2 hours to get to Tinoch, get a fish and chips basket at Jan's wharfside, sit at a table eating it while he looks out at the water, and then catch the last ferry to Moose Lookout Island.
As he spoke, he slowly brought Stephanie's left and right forefingers together until they touched. Stephanie watched, fascinated.
Could he do it?
Maybe, but it'd be awful goddamn tight, Dave said with a sigh. I'd have never believed it if he hadn't actually turned up dead on Hammock Beach. Would you, Vince?
Nope, Vince said, without even pausing to consider.
Dave said,
there's far dirt airstrips within a dozen miles or so of Tinoch, all seasonal. They do most of their trade, taking up tourists on sightseeing rides in the summer. I have to look at the fall foliage when the colors peek out, although that only lasts a couple of weeks. We checked him on the off chance that Cogan might have chatted him a second plane, this one a little prop job like a Piper Cub, and flown from Bangor to the coast. No joy there either, I take it.
You take it right,
Vince said, and his grin was gloomy rather than foxy.
Once those elevator doors slide closed on Cogan in that Denver office building, this whole business is nothing but shadows you can't quite catch hold of, and one dead body. Three of those far airstrips were deserted in April, shut right down, so a plane could have flown into any of them, and no one the wiser. The fourth one, a woman named Maisie Harrington lived out there with her father and about 60 mutt dogs, and she claimed that no one flew into their strip from October of 1979 to May of 1980. But she smelled like a distillery. I had my doubts if she could remember what went on a week before I talked to her, let alone a year and a half before.
What about the woman's father? She asked.
Stone blind and one-legged, Dave said. The diabetes.
Ouch, she said.
Let Jack and Maisie Harrington go hang, Vince said impatiently. I never believed in the second airplane theory when it comes to Cogan any more than I ever believed in the second gunman theory when it came to Kennedy. If Cogan had a car waiting for him in Denver, and I can't see any way around it, then he could have had one waiting for him at the General Aviation Terminal as well. And I believe he did. That is just so far-fetched, Dave said.
He spoke not scoffingly, but dolefully.
Perhaps, Vince responded unperturbed, but when you get rid of the impossible, whatever's left, there's your pup scratching at the door to be let in.
He could have driven himself, Stephanie said thoughtfully.
Well, rental car? Dave shook his head. Don't think so, dear. Rental agencies take only credit cards, and credit cards leave paper trails. Besides, Vince said, Cogan didn't know his way around eastern and coastal Maine. Suppose we can discover he'd never been here in his life. You know the roads by now, Steffi. There's only one main one that comes out this way from Bangor to Ellsworth. But once you get to Ellsworth, there's three or four different choices, and a flatlander, even one with a map, is apt to get confused. No, I think Dave is right. If the kid meant to go by car, and if he knew in advance how small his time window was going to be, he would have wanted to have a driver standing by and waiting. Somebody who'd take cash money, drive fast, and not get lost.
Stephanie thought for a little while. The two old men let her. Three hired drivers in all, she said at last. The one in the middle at the controls of a private jet.
Maybe with a co-pilot, Dave put in quietly. Them are the rules, at least.
It's very outlandish, she said. Vince nodded and sighed.
I don't disagree.
You've never turned up even one of these drivers, have you?
Nope.
She thought some more, this time with her head down and her normally smooth brow furrowed in a deep frown. Once more they did not interrupt her, and after perhaps 2 minutes she looked up again. But why? What could be so important for Cogan to go to such lengths? Vince Teague and Dave Bowie looked at each other, then back at her. Vince said,
Ain't that a good question?
Dave said,
A rig of a question.
Vince said,
The main question.
Of course it is, Dave said. Always was.
Vince, quite softly.
We don't know, Stephanie. We never have.
Dave, more softly still.
Boston Globe wouldn't like that.
Nope, not at all.
17.
Of course we ain't the Boston Globe, Vince said. We ain't even the Bangor Daily News. But, Stephanie, when a grown man or woman goes completely off the rails,
Every newspaper writer, big town or small one, looks for certain reasons. It don't matter whether the result is most of the Methodist church picnic winding up poisoned, or just a gentlemanly half of a marriage quietly disappearing one weekday morning, never to be seen alive again. Now, for the time being, never minding where he wound up, or the improbability of how he managed to get there, tell me what some of those reasons for going off the rails might be. Count them off for me until I see at least 4 of your fingers in the air.
School is in session, she thought, and then remembered something Vince had said to her a month before, almost in passing.
To be a success in the news business, it don't hurt to have a dirty mind, dear.
At the time, she'd thought the remark bizarre, perhaps even borderline senile. Now she thought she understood a little better. Sex, she said, raising her left forefinger, her Colorado kid finger, i.e. another woman. She popped another finger. Money problems. I'm thinking either debt or theft.
Don't forget the IRS, Dave said. People sometimes run when they realize they're in hock to Uncle Sam. She don't know how boogery the IRS can be, Vince said. You can't hold that against her. Anyway, according to his wife, Cogan had no problems with Infernal Revenue. Go on, Steffi, you're doing fine.
She didn't yet have enough fingers in the air to satisfy him, but could think of only one other thing. The urge to start a brand new life? She asked doubtfully, seeming to speak more to herself than to them. To just, I don't know, cut all the ties and start over again as a different person in a different place? And then something else did occur to her. Madness? She had 4 fingers up now, 1 for sex, 1 for money, 1 for change, 1 for madness. She looked doubtfully at the last 2. Maybe change and madness are the same?
Maybe they are, Vince said. And you could argue that madness covers all sorts of addictions that people try to run from. That sort of running's sometimes known as the geographic cure. I'm thinking specifically of drugs and alcohol. Gambling's another addiction people try the geographic cure on, but I guess you could file that problem under money.
Did he have drug or alcohol problems?
Alla Cogan said not. I believe she would have known. After 16 months to think it over, and with him dead at the end of it, I think she would have told me. But, Steffi, Dave said, and rather gently, when you consider it, madness almost has to be in it somewhere. Wouldn't you say?
She thought of James Cogan, the Colorado kid, sitting dead on Hammock Beach with his back against a litter basket and a lump of meat lodged in his throat, his closed eyes turned in the direction of Tinnock and the reach beyond. She thought of how one hand still had been curled as if holding the rest of his midnight snack, a piece of steak some hungry gull no doubt had stolen, leaving nothing but a sticky pattern of sand in the leftover grease on his palm.
Yes, she said. There's madness in it somewhere.
Did she know that, his wife? The 2 men looked at each other. Vince sighed and rubbed the side of his blade-thin nose.
She might have, but then she had her own life to worry about, Steffi. Hers and her son's. A man up and disappears like that. A woman left behind is apt to have a damn hard skate. She got her old job back, working in one of the Boulder banks, but there was no way she could keep the house in Nederland.
Hernando's hideaway, Stephanie murmured, feeling a sympathetic pang.
Oh, yeah, that. She kept on her feet without having to borrow too much from her folks, or anything at all from his, but she used up most of the money they'd put aside for little Mike's college education in the process. When we saw her, I should judge she wanted 2 things. One practical, and one what you'd call spiritual.
He looked rather doubtfully at Dave, who shrugged and nodded, as if to say that word would do. Vince nodded himself and went on.
She wanted to be shed of the not knowing. Was he alive or dead? Was she married or a widow? Could she lay hope to rest, or did she have to carry it yet a while longer? Maybe that last sounds a trifle hard-hearted, and maybe it is, but I should think that after 16 months, Hope must get damned heavy on your back, damned heavy to tote around.
As for the practical, that was simple. She just wanted the insurance company to pay off what they owed. I know that Alec Hogan isn't the only person in the history of the world to hate an insurance company, but I'd have to put her high on the list for sheer intensity. She'd been going along and going along, you see, her and Michael, living in a 3 or 5 room apartment in Boulder, quite a change after the nice house in Nederland, and her leaving him in daycare and with babysitters she wasn't always sure she could trust, working a job she didn't really want to do, going to bed alone after years of having someone to snuggle up to, worrying over the bills, always watching the needle on the gas gauge because the price of gasoline was going up even then, and all the time she was sure in her heart that he was dead. But the insurance company wouldn't pay off because of what her heart knew, not when there was no body, let alone a cause of death. She kept asking me if the bastards, that's what she always called them, could wiggle off somehow, if they could claim it was a suicide. I told her I'd never heard of someone committing suicide by choking themselves on a piece of meat, and later, after she had made the formal identification of the death photo in Cathcart's presence, he told her the same thing. That seemed to ease her mind a little bit. Cathcart pitched right in, said he'd call the company agent in Brighton, Colorado, and explain about the fingerprints and her photo ID, nail everything down tight. She cried quite a little bit at that, some in relief, some in gratitude, some just from exhaustion, I guess.
Of course, Stephanie murmured.
I took her across to Moosey on the ferry and put her up at the Red Roof Motel, Vince continued. Same place you stayed when you first got here, wasn't it?
Yes, Stephanie said. She had been at a boarding house for the last month or so, but would look for something more permanent in October. If, that was, these two old birds would keep her on. She thought they would. She thought that was, in large part, what this was all about.
The three of us had breakfast next morning, Dave said. And like most people who haven't done anything wrong and haven't had much experience with newspapers, she had no shyness about talking to us, no sense that any of what she was saying might later turn up on page one. He paused. And of course, very little of it ever did. It was never the kind of story that sees much in the way of print. Once you get past the main fact of the matter, man found dead on Hammock Beach, coroner says no foul play. And by then that was cold news indeed.
No through line, Stephanie said.
No, nothing, Dave cried, and then laughed until he coughed.
When that cleared, he wiped the corners of his eyes with a large paisley handkerchief he pulled from the back pocket of his pants.
What did she tell you? Stephanie asked.
What could she tell us? Vince responded. Mostly what she did was ask questions. The only one I asked her was if the Chervonitz was a lucky piece or a memento or something like that, he snorted. Some newspaper man I was that day.
The chevron? She gave up on it, shaking her head.
The Russian coin in his pocket, mixed in with the rest of his change, Vince said. It was a Chervonitz, a 10-ruble piece. I asked her if he kept it as a lucky piece or something. She didn't have a clue. Said the closest Jim had ever been to Russia was when they rented a James Bond movie called From Russia with Love at Blockbuster.
He might have picked it up on the beach, she said thoughtfully. People find all sorts of things on the beach. She herself had found a woman's high-heel shoe, worn exotically smooth from many a long tumble between the sea and the shore, while walking one day on Little Hay Beach, about 2 miles from Hammock.
Might have, yeah, Vince agreed.
He looked at her, his eyes twinkling in their deep sockets.
Want to know the two things I remember best about her the morning after her appointment with Cathcart over in Tinnock?
Sure.
How rested she looked, and how well she ate when we sat down to breakfast.
Well, that's a fact, Dave agreed. There's that old saying about how the condemned man ate a hearty meal, but I've got an idea that no one ain't so hatty as the man or the woman who's finally been up and paddened. And in a way, she had been. She might not have known why he came to our part of the world or what befell him once he got here, and I think she realized she might not ever know.
She did, Vince agreed. She said so when I drove her back to the airport.
But she knew the only important thing. He was dead. Her heart might have been telling her that all along, but her head needed proof to go along for the ride.
Not to mention in order to convince that pesky insurance company, Dave said.
Did she ever get the money? Stephanie asked.
Dave smiled. Yes, ma'am. They dragged their feet some. Those boys have a tendency to go fast when they're putting on the sell job and then slow down when someone puts in a claim. But finally they paid. We got a letter to that effect thanking us for all our hard work. She said that without us, she'd still be wondering, and the insurance company would still be claiming that James Cogan could be alive in Brooklyn or Tangiers.
What kind of questions did she ask?
The ones you'd expect, Vince said. First thing she wanted to know was where he went when he got off the ferry. We couldn't tell her. We asked questions, didn't we, Dave?
Dave Bowie nodded.
But no one remembered seeing him, Vince continued. Of course, it would have been almost full dark by then, so there's no reason why anyone should have. As for the few other passengers, and at that time of year there aren't many, especially on the last ferry of the day, they would have gone right to their cars in the Bay Street parking lot, heads down in their collars because of the wind off the reach.
And she asked about his wallet, Dave said. All we could tell her was that no one ever found it, at least no one who ever turned it into the police. Well, I suppose it's possible someone could have picked it out of his pocket on the ferry, stripped the cash out of it, then dropped it overside.
It's possible that heaven's a rodeo, too, but not likely, Vince said dryly. If he had cash in his wallet, why did he have Ma, $17 in paper money, in his pants pocket?
Just in case, Stephanie said.
Maybe, Vince said, but it doesn't feel right to me. And frankly, I find the idea of a pickpocket working the 6 o'clock ferry between Tinoch and Moosey a touch more unbelievable than a commercial artist from a Denver advertising agency chartering a jet to fly to New England.
In any case, we couldn't tell her where his wallet went, Dave said.
Where his topcoat and suit jacket went. Why he was found sitting out there on a stretch of beach in nothing but his pants and shirt.
The cigarettes? Stephanie asked. I'll bet she was curious about those. Vince barked a laugh.
Curious isn't the right word.
That pack of smokes drove her almost crazy. She couldn't understand why he'd have had cigarettes on him. And we didn't need her to tell us he wasn't the kind who'd stopped for a while and then decided to take the habit up again.
Cathcart took a good look at his lungs during the autopsy, for reasons I'm sure you'll understand.
He wanted to make sure he hadn't drowned, after all, Stephanie asked.
That's right, Vince said. If Dr. Cathcart had found water in the lungs beneath that chunk of meat, it would have suggested someone trying to cover up the way Mr. Cogan actually died. And while that wouldn't have proved murder, it would have suggested it. Cathcart didn't find water in Cogan's lungs, and he didn't find any evidence of smoking either. Nice and pink down there, he said. Yet someplace between Cogan's office building and Stapleton Airport, and in spite of the tearing hurry he had to have been in, he must have had his driver stop so he could pick up a pack. Either that or he had him put by already, which is what I tend to believe. Maybe with his Russian coin.
Did you tell her that? Stephanie asked.
No, Vince said.
And just then the telephone rang.
Excuse me, he said, and went to answer it.
He spoke briefly, said Aya, a time or three, then returned, stretching his back some more as he did.
That was Ellen Dunwoody, he said. She's ready to talk about the great trauma she's been through, snapping off that fire hydrant and making a spectacle of herself. That's an exact quote, although I don't think it will appear in my pulse-pounding account of the event. In any case, I think I'd better ramble over there pretty soon.
Get the story while her recollection's clear and before she decides to make supper. I'm lucky she and her sister eat late, otherwise I'd be out of luck.
I've got to get after those invoices, Dave said. Seems like there must be a dozen more than there were when we left for the Gull.
I swan to goodness, when you leave them alone atop a desk, they breed.
Stephanie gazed at them with real alarm. You can't stop now. You can't just leave me hanging.
No other choice, Vince said mildly. We've been hanging, Steffi, and for 25 years now. There isn't any jilted church secretary in this one.
No Ellsworth city lights reflected on the clouds down east, either, Dave said. Not even a Theodore Ripino in the picture. Some poor old sailorman murdered for hypothetical pirate treasure and then left to die on the far deck in his own blood after all his shipmates had been tossed overside. And why? As a warning to other would-be treasure hunters, by gory. Now there's a through line for you, dear hat.
Dave grinned, but then the grin faded.
Nothing like that in the case of the Colorado Kid. No string for the beads, don't you see? And no Sherlock Holmes or Ellery Queen to string him in any case. Just a couple of guys running a newspaper with about 100 stories a week to cover. None of them drawing much water by Boston Globe standards, but stuff people on the island like to read about all the same. Speaking of which, weren't you going to talk with Sam Gannard, find out all the details on his famous hayride dance and picnic?
I was, I am, and I want to. Do you guys understand that? That I actually want to talk to him about that dumb thing? Vince Teague burst out laughing, and Dave joined him.
Well, Vince said when he could talk again, dunno what the head of your journalism department would make of it, Steffi. He'd probably break down and cry, but I know you do.
He glanced at Dave.
We know you do.
And I know you've got your own fish to fry, but you must have some ideas, some theories, after all these years. She looked at them plaintively. I mean, don't you? They glanced at each other, and again she felt that telepathy flow between them. But this time she had no sense of the thought it carried. Then Dave looked back at her.
What is it you really want to know, Stephanie? Tell us.
18. Do you think he was murdered? That was what she really wanted to know. They had asked her to set the idea aside, and she had, but now the discussion of the Colorado Kid was almost over, and she thought they would allow her to put the subject back on the table.
Why would you think that any more likely than accidental death, given everything we've told you?
Dave asked. He sounded genuinely curious.
Because of the cigarettes. The cigarettes almost had to have been deliberate on his part.
He just never thought it would take a year and a half for someone to discover that Colorado stamp. Cogan believed a man found dead on a beach with no identification would rate more investigation than he got.
Yes, Vince said.
He spoke in a low voice, but actually clenched a fist and shook it, like a fan who has just watched a ball player make a key play or deliver a clutch hit.
Good girl. Good job.
Although just 22, there were people Stephanie would have resented for calling her a girl. This 90-year-old man with the thin white hair, narrow face, and piercing blue eyes was not one of them. In truth, she flushed with pleasure.
He couldn't know he'd draw a couple of thuds like O'Shanny and Morrison when it came time to investigate his death, Dave said. Couldn't know he'd have to depend on a grad student who'd spent the last couple of months holding briefcases and going out for coffee, not to mention a couple of old guys putting out a weekly paper one step above a supermarket handout. Hang on there, brother, Vince said. Them's fighting words.
He put up his elderly dukes, but with a grin. I think he did all right, Stephanie said. In the end, I think he did just fine. And then, thinking of the woman and baby Michael, who would by this time be in his mid-20s, so did she, actually. Without Paul Devane and you two guys, Arla Cogan would never have gotten her insurance money.
Some truth to that, Vince conceded.
She was amused to see that something in this made him uncomfortable. Not that he'd done good, she thought, but that someone knew he had done good. They had the internet out here. You could see a little DirecTV satellite dish on just about every house. No fishing boat set to sea anymore without the GPS switched on. Yet still the old Calvinist ideas ran deep. Let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth.
What exactly do you think happened? She asked. No, Steffi, Vince said.
He spoke kindly but firmly.
You're still expecting Rex Stout to come waltzing out of the closet, or Ellery Queen, Am, and I'm with Miss Jane Marple. If we knew what happened, if we had any idea, we would have chased that idea till we dropped. And frig the Boston Globe, we would have broken any story we found on page one of the Islander. We may have been little newspapermen back in 81, and we may be little old newspapermen now, but we ain't dead little old newspapermen. I still like the idea of a big story just fine.
Me too, Dave said.
He'd gotten up, probably with those invoices on his mind, but had now settled on the corner of his desk, swinging one large leg.
I've always dreamed of us having a story that got syndicated nationwide. That's one dream I'll probably die with. Go on, Vince, tell her as much as you think. She'll keep it close. She's one of us now.
Stephanie almost shivered with pleasure, but Vince Teague appeared not to notice. He leaned forward, fixing her light blue eyes with his, which were a much darker shade, the color of the ocean on a sunny day.
All right, he said. I started to think something might be funny about how he died as well as how he got here, long before all that about the stamp. I started asking myself questions when I realized he had a pack of cigarettes with only one gone, although he'd been on the island at least since 6:30. I made a real pest of myself at Bayside Nose.
Vince smiled at the recollection.
I showed everyone at the shop Cogan's picture, including the sweep-up boy. I was convinced he must have bought that pack there, unless he got it out of a vending machine at a place like the Red Roof, the Shuffle Inn, or maybe Sonny's Sunoco. The way I figured, he must have finished his smokes while wandering around Moosey after getting off the ferry, then bought a fresh supply. I also figured that if he got him at the news, he must have gotten him shortly before 11, which is when the news closes. That would explain why he just smoked one and only used one of his new matches before he died.
But then you found out he wasn't a smoker at all, Stephanie said.
That's right. His wife said so, and Cathcart confirmed it. Later on I became sure that pack of smokes was a message. I came from Colorado. Look for me there. We'll never know for sure, but we both think that's what it was, Dave said.
Jesus, she almost whispered.
So where does that lead you? Once more they looked at each other and shrugged those identical shrugs.
Into a land of shadows and moonbeams, Vince said. Places no feature writer from the Boston Globe will ever go, in other words. But there are a few things I'm sure of in my heart. Would you like to hear them?
Yes.
Vince spoke slowly but deliberately, like a man feeling his way down a very dark corridor where he has been many times before.
He knew he was going into a desperate situation, and he knew he might go unidentified if he died. He didn't want that to happen, quite likely because he was worried about leaving his wife broke.
So he bought those cigarettes, hoping they'd be overlooked, Stephanie said. Vince nodded.
Yeah, and they were.
But overlooked by who? Vince paused, then went on without answering her question.
He went down in the elevator and out through the lobby of his building. There was a car waiting to take him to Stapleton Airport, either right there or just round the corner. Maybe it was just him and the driver in that car. Maybe there was someone else. We'll never know. He
You asked me earlier if Cogan was wearing his overcoat when he left that morning, and I said Judge, the artist, didn't remember. But Alice said she never saw that overcoat no more. So maybe he was, at that. If so, I think he took it off in the car, or in the airplane. I think he also took off his suit coat jacket. I think someone either gave him the green jacket to wear in their place, or it was waiting for him.
In the car, or on the plane?
Yeah, Dave said.
The cigarettes?
Don't know for sure, but if I had to bet, I'd bet he already had 'em on him, Dave said. He knew this was coming along, whatever this was. He'd have had 'em in his pants pocket, I think.
Then later, on the beach, she saw Cogan, her mind's eye version of the Colorado Kid, lighting his life's first cigarette, first and last, and then strolling down to the water's edge with it, there on Hammock Beach, alone in the moonlight, the midnight moonlight. He takes one puff of the harsh, unfamiliar smoke, maybe two, then he throws the cigarette into the sea. Then, what? What? The plane dropped him off in Bangor, she heard herself saying in a voice that sounded harsh and unfamiliar to herself.
Yeah, Dave agreed.
And his ride from Bangor dropped him off in Tinnock.
Yeah.
That was Vince. He ate a fish and chips basket.
So he did, Vince agreed. Autopsy proves it. So did my nose. I smelled the vinegar.
Was his wallet gone by then?
We don't know, Dave said. We'll never know, but I think so. I think he gave it up with his top coat, his suit coat, and his normal life. I think what he got in return was a green jacket, which he also gave up later on. I had taken from his dead body, Vince said.
Stephanie shivered. She couldn't help it. He rides across to Moose Lookout Island on the 6 o'clock ferry, bringing guard Edwick a paper cup of coffee on the way, what could be construed as tea for the tillerman or the ferryman.
Well, Dave said. He looked very solemn.
By then he has no wallet, no ID, just $17 and some change that maybe includes a Russian 10-ruble coin. Do you think that coin might have been, oh, I don't know, some sort of identification thingy, like in a spy novel? I mean, the Cold War between Russia and the United States would have still been going on then, right?
Full blast, Vince said. But, Steffi, if you were going to dicker with a Russian secret agent, would you use a ruble to introduce yourself?
No, she admitted. But why else would he have it? To show it to someone, that's all I can think of.
I've always had the intuition that someone gave it to him, Dave said. Maybe along with a piece of cold sirloin steak wrapped up in a piece of tinfoil.
Why? She asked. Why would they? Dave shook his head.
I don't know.
Was there tinfoil found at the scene? Maybe thrown into that seagrass along the far edge of the beach?
Old Shanning and Morrison sure didn't look, Dave said. Me and Vince had a hunt all round Hammock Beach after that yellow tape was taken down. Not specifically for tinfoil, you understand, but for anything that looked like it might bear on the dead man, anything at all. We found nothing but the usual litter, candy wrappers and such. If the meat was in foil, or a baggie, the kid might very well have tossed it into the water, along with his one cigarette, Vince said.
About that piece of meat in his throat. Vince was smiling a little.
I had several long conversations about that piece of steak with both Doc Robinson and Dr. Cathcart. Dave was in on a couple of them. I remember Cathcart saying to me once, this had to have been not more than a month before the heart attack that took his life 6 or 7 years ago. You go back to that old business the way a kid who's lost a tooth goes back to the hole with the tip of his tongue. And I thought to myself, yep, that's exactly right. Exactly what it's like. It's like a hole I can't stop poking at and looking into, trying to find the bottom of. First thing I wanted to know was if that piece of meat could have been jammed down Cogan's throat, either with fingers or some sort of instrument like a lobster pick, after he was dead. And that's crossed your mind, hasn't it?
Stephanie nodded.
He said it was possible, but unlikely, because that piece of steak had not only been chewed, but chewed enough to be swallowed. It wasn't really meat at all anymore, but rather what Cathcart called organic pulp mass. Someone else could have chewed it that much, but would have been unlikely to have planted it after doing so, for fear that it would have looked insufficient to cause death. Are you with me?
She nodded again.
He also said that meat chewed to a pulp mass would be had to manipulate with an instrument. It would tend to break up when pushed from the back of the mouth into the throat. Fingers could do it, but Cathcart said he believed he would have seen signs of that, most likely straining of the jaw ligatures.
He paused, thinking, then shook his head.
There's a technical term for that kind of jaw popping, but I don't remember it.
Tell her what Robinson told you, Dave said. His eyes were sparkling.
It didn't come to no more than the rest in the end, but I always thought it was wicked interesting. He said there were certain muscle relaxants, some of them exotic, and Cogan's midnight snack might have been treated with one of those, Vince said. He might get the first few bites down all right, accounting for what was found in his stomach, and then find himself all at once with a bite he wasn't able to swallow once it was chewed.
That must have been it, Stephanie cried. Whoever dosed the meat sat there and just watched him choke. Then, when Cogan was dead, the murderer propped him up against the litter basket and took away the rest of the steak so it could never be tested. It was never a gull at all, it... She stopped, looking at them. Why are you shaking your heads?
The autopsy, dear, Vince said. Nothing like that showed up on the blood gas chromatograph tests.
But if it was something exotic enough...
Like in an Agatha Christie yarn? Vince asked, with a wink and a little smile. Well, maybe. But there was also the piece of meat in his throat, don't you know?
Oh, right. Dr. Cathcart had that to test, didn't he? She slumped a little.
Yeah, Vince agreed. And did. We may be country mice, but we do have the occasional Dak thought. And the closest thing to poison on that chunk of chewed-up meat was a little salt.
She was silent for a moment. Then she said, in a very low voice, "Maybe it was the kind of stuff that disappears."
"Oh, yeah," Dave said, and his tongue rounded the inside of one cheek. "Like the ghost lights after an hour or two." "Like the rest of Lisa Cabot's crew," Vince added.
"And once he got off the ferry, you don't know where he went?"
"No, ma'am," Vince said. "We've looked off and on for over 25 years, and never found a soul who claims to have seen him before Johnny and Nancy did around 6:15 in the morning of April 24th. And for the record, not that anyone's keeping one, I don't believe that anyone took what remained of that steak from his hand after he choked on his last bite. I believe that a seagull stole the last of it from his dead hand, just as we always surmised. And, gory, I really do have to get a move on."
"Now I have to get with those invoices," Dave said.
"But first, I think another little rest stop might be in order."
That said, he lumbered toward the bathroom. "I suppose I'd better get with this column," Stephanie said. Then she burst out, half laughing and half serious. "But I almost wish you hadn't told me if you were going to leave me hanging. It'll be weeks before I get this out of my mind."
"It's been 25 years, and it's still not out of ours," Vince said. "And at least you know why we didn't tell that guy from the Globe."
"Yes, I do." He smiled and nodded.
"You'll do all right, Stephanie. You'll do fine."
He gave her shoulder a friendly squeeze, then started for the door, grabbing his narrow reporter's notebook from his littered desk on his way by and stuffing it into his back pocket. He was 90, but still walked easy, his back only slightly bent with age. He wore a gentleman's white shirt, its back crisscrossed with a gentleman's suspenders. Halfway across the room, he stopped and turned to her again. A shaft of late sunlight caught his baby fine white hair and turned it into a halo.
"You've been a pleasure to have around,"
he said. I want you to know that.
Thank you. She hoped she didn't sound as close to tears as she suddenly felt. It's been wonderful. I was a little dubious at first, but now I guess it goes right back at you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Have you thought about staying? I think you have.
Yes, you bet I have.
He nodded gravely. Dave and I have spoken about that. It'd be good to have some new blood on the staff, some young blood.
You guys will go on for years, she said.
Oh, yes, he said, offhandedly, as if that were a given.
And when he died 6 months later, Stephanie would sit in a cold church, taking notes on the service in her own narrow reporter's book and think, he knew it was coming.
I'll be around for years yet. Still, if you wanted to stay, we'd like to have you. You don't have to answer one way or another now, but consider it an offer.
All right. I will. And I think we both know what the answer will be.
That's fine, then.
He started to turn, then turned back one last time.
School's almost out for the day, but I could tell you one more thing about our business. May I?
Of course.
There are thousands of papers and tens of thousands of people writing stories for them. But there are only two types of stories. There are news stories, which usually aren't stories at all, but only accounts of unfolding events. Things like that don't have to be stories. People pick up a newspaper to read about the blood and the tears, the way they slow down to look at a wreck on the highway, and then they move on. But what do they find inside of their newspaper?
Feature stories, Stephanie said, thinking of Hanratty and his unexplained mysteries.
Yeah? And those are stories. Every one of them has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That makes them happy news, Steffi, always happy news. Even if the story is about a church secretary who probably killed half the congregation at the church picnic because her lover jilted her, that is happy news. And why?
I don't know.
You better, Dave said, emerging from the bathroom and still wiping his hands on a paper towel.
You better know if you want to be in this business and understand what it is you're doing.
He cast the paper towel into his wastebasket on his way by. She thought about it. Feature stories are happy stories because they're over.
That's right, Vince cried, beaming.
He threw his hands in the air like a revival preacher.
They have resolution. They have closure. But do things have a beginning, a middle, and an end in real life, Stephanie? What does your experience tell you?
When it comes to newspaper work, I don't have much, she said. Just the campus paper and, you know, arts and things here. Vince waved this away.
Your heart and mind, what do they tell you?
That life usually doesn't work that way. She was thinking of a certain young man who would have to be dealt with if she decided to stay here beyond her 4 months. And that dealing might be messy, probably would be messy. Rick would not take the news well. Because in Rick's mind, that wasn't how the story was supposed to go.
I never read a feature story that wasn't a lie, Vince said mildly. But usually you can make a lie fit on the page. This one would never fit. Unless...
He gave a little shrug. For a moment, she didn't know what that shrug meant. Then she remembered something Dave had said not long after they'd gone out to sit on the deck, to sit in the late August sunshine. It's ours, he'd said, sounding almost angry.
A guy from the Globe, a guy from away, he'd only muck it up.
If you'd given this to Hanratty, he would have used it, wouldn't he? She asked them.
Wasn't ours to give, because we don't own it, Vince said. It belongs to whoever tracks it down.
Smiling a little, Stephanie shook her head. I think that's disingenuous. I think you and Dave are the last two people alive who know the whole thing.
We were, Dave said. Now there's you, Steffi.
She nodded to him, acknowledging the implicit compliment, then turned her attention back to Vince Teague, eyebrows raised. After a second or two, he chuckled.
We didn't tell him about the Colorado Kid, because he would have taken a true unexplained mystery and made it into just another feature story, Vince said. Not by changing any of the facts, but by emphasizing one thing. The concept of muscle relaxants making it hard or impossible to swallow, let's say, and leaving something else out.
That there was absolutely no sign of anything like that in this case, for instance, Stephanie said.
Oh, yeah, maybe that, maybe something else. And maybe he would have written it in that way on his own, simply because making a story out of things that ain't quite a story on their own gets to be a habit after a certain number of years in this business. Or maybe his editor would have sent it back to him to do on a rewrite.
Or the editor might have done it himself if time was tight, Dave put in.
Yep, editors have been known to do that as well, Vince agreed. In any case, the Colorado Kid would most likely have ended up being installment number 7 or 8 in Hanratty's Unexplained Mysteries of New England series, something for people to marvel over for 15 minutes or so on Sunday and line their kitty litter boxes with on Monday.
And it wouldn't be yours anymore, Stephanie said. Dave nodded, but Vince waved his hand as if to say, oh, pish-tush.
That I could put up with, but it would have hung a lie around the neck of a man who ain't alive to refute it. And that I won't put up with, because I don't have to.
He glanced at his watch.
In any case, I'm on my hoss. Whichever one of you's last out the door, be sure to lock it behind you, all right?
Vince left. They watched him go, then Dave turned back to her.
Any more questions?
She laughed. 100, but none you or Vince could answer, I guess.
Just as long as you don't get tired of asking them, that's fine.
He wandered off to his desk, sat down, and pulled a stack of papers toward him with a sigh. Stephanie started back toward her own desk, and something caught her eye on the wall-length bulletin board at the far end of the room opposite Vince's cluttered desk. She walked over for a closer look. The left half of the bulletin board was layered with old front pages of the Islander, most yellowed and curling. High in the corner, all by itself, was the front page from the week of July 9, 1952. The headline read, Mystery Lights Over Hancock Fascinate Thousands. Below was a photograph credited to one Vincent Teague, who would have been just 37 back then if she had her math right. The crisp black and white showed a Little League field with a billboard in deep center reading, Hancock Lumber Always Knows the Score. To Stephanie, the photo looked as if it had been snapped at twilight. The few adults in the single set of sagging bleachers were standing and looking up into the sky. So was the ump, who stood straddling home plate with his mask in his right hand. One set of players, the visiting team, she assumed, was bunched tightly together around third base, as if for comfort. The other kids, wearing jeans and jerseys with the words Hancock Lumber printed on the back, stood in a rough line across the infield, all staring upward. And on the mound, the little boy who had been pitching held his glove up to one of the bright circles which hung in the sky just below the clouds, as if to touch that mystery, and bring it close, and open its heart, and know its story.
The Colorado Kid was written by Stephen King and read by Jeffrey DeMunn. It was engineered by Paul Fowley with editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Sarah Ginsberg. The Colorado Kid was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.